COVID-19 coronavirus is spreading to more countries globally. While there are still only a small number of cases in Canada, it is important to be prepared. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic the flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to stay home and self-isolate, or to seek medical attention. Wash hands frequently for 20 seconds with soap and water, or disinfect with an alcohol-based hand rub. Avoid touching eyes, mouth, and nose. Practice good respiratory etiquette. Cover your coughs and sneezes with your arm or use a tissue. Clean regularly used surfaces and objects like countertops, doorknobs, and children's toys. Maintain social distance. Stay at least 2 meters away from someone who is coughing or sneezing. Instead of a handshake, use a wave or another greeting. For more up-to-date information on COVID-19, check reliable sources like your local health authority, the Public Health Agency of Canada, or the World Health Organization.
Racism. Is it racist? That's not going to be your topic today, is it? Sure it is. What's wrong with that? Everything? Anything about race is offensive. I don't know. Isn't the idea that race might offend people kind of racist itself? Besides, my show is going to be about how racism might not be about race. Yeah, I think that's the offensive part. I don't know. You probably just grew up coddled and programmed to believe that exploring race is too sensitive and too dangerous. Let's put that aside and see if we can ask some interesting new questions. Like, people on social media constantly argue about whether or not somebody is racist, but they never ask whether racism is racist or not. I don't even know what that question is supposed to mean. Don't worry about it. People are going to love this show. Racism! Is it racist or not? Let's go to the phones. Caller 1, you're on the air. Okay, caller 1 was killed and eaten by unknown assailants. I'm Layman Pascal, but you can call me Carruthers because no one is named Carruthers anymore. You're listening to the Cinematic Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM. And today we're asking, is racism racist?
Suppose in disguises no one knows, hides the face, lies the snake, and the sun in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, 'neath the black sky. Sun, won't you come and wash away the rain? Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come, won't you come? Stuttering, cold and damp, steal the warmth with tires ran. Times are gone for honest men, and sometimes far too long for slaves. In my shoes, walking slim, in my soul I pray to keep. Heaven sent, hell away. No one sings like you anymore. Sun, won't you come, ba 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 ba, wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come, ooh, won't you come. drown my fears till you all just disappear. Black hole sign, won't you come?
I know. It seems like a no-brainer that racism is about race, but I'm just not sure. Maybe I could be convinced, but doesn't it also seem like there are times when people make racial distinctions that aren't that problematic, and other times when people demonstrate the same kind of bigoted emotional, physical, and socioeconomic patterns that make racism so bad, but about things that aren't necessarily race? I don't know. What about you? Do you ever see racist ugliness in people when they're talking about or dealing with groups that aren't divided up by race? And do you ever get into discussions where you're worried about even acknowledging racial difference and it turns out it's fine and everyone wants you to legitimately acknowledge a kind of discrimination or distinction making so that different groups of people with different situations can all be honored for their differences? I find that confusing. It muddles the edges of the very concept of racism for me. This is a tricky topic to talk about, I know. On the one hand, I don't want to invalidate or even really challenge the experience and moral clarity of people who belong to groups that have not only been abused and systematically disadvantaged by more dominant populations, but who have also had to fight for generations just to be heard and not attacked, and who are constantly, often legitimately, on guard against any sign of those old suppressive patterns rising against them. That stuff's all pretty legit. But as a kind of humanitarian universalist, or even as something of an alien visitor to this planet, I can't help being weirded out by how lazy human beings are when it comes to grouping themselves into categories. And I mean the categories we group other people into and the categories we group ourselves into. I always think racists and sexists are lazy because they're discriminating on the basis of such obvious features. Skin pigment, language, hair length, genitals, easy things. I've said before on this show that if we had to discriminate on the basis of pancreas shape or gut bacteria, that prejudice would have never gotten off the ground. No one wants to do a lot of nuanced work before dissing, dismissing, disparaging, and dehumanizing other people. We want to do that quickly, at a glance, and in keeping with the way we've already heard lots of others disparaging and dehumanizing in the past. Maybe one of the reasons that anti-Semitism is still with us is simply that it has a precedent historically and that the prejudiced are just too lazy to start suspecting and bad-mouthing a new group. They don't want to put the work in. They want to jump on a prejudice that's already going. Why drag the sled up to the top of the hill when you can leap on when it's halfway down and already moving? And that's what I call the sled theory of ethnocentric discrimination.
Thank you.
That was the Deadwood theme by David Schwartz. I've been watching the show Deadwood. I didn't catch it the first time round. It's like Shakespeare on the frontier. King Lear soaked in muck and profanities. Very engaging. Terrific actors. A lot of people who seem like they're villains when you first meet them, but slowly you unravel the many contradictions in their characters. One of the most interesting things on the show Deadwood are the old-timey racial slurs. The local Indians, for example, are referred to as dirt worshippers, a derogatory term for something that actually sounds pretty positive. That is to say, sacred naturalism, the sense of the divinity of ecology, the sacerdotal nature of the elements that make up our actual world. That's hardly a bad thing. It might even be the very thing our civilization needs in order to regain health, depth, and a responsible capacity to steward the earth for coming generations. However, it's described on the show in terms that sound pretty negative. Dirt worshipper. And it's not just the word, it's how you enunciate the word. Most derogatory group slang terms, whether they are seriously prejudiced or just part of the casual negativity of human intercourse, have a certain recognizable tonality to them. You can almost guess whether someone who doesn't speak your language is using a disreputable term about whatever group he or she thinks you belong to or represent. Bunch of whelk licksters, bunch of clegs, nothing but jilts, no good dirty meeps, a pack of tunches, lousy grelts, lousy gengers. You know, Genger's gang, that's why they're called that. It's just a descriptive term, of course, but it sure sounds like there's some implied disrespect, doesn't it? Anyway, on Deadwood, the English folks call the Chinese folks Celestials. How about that? That's a pretty remarkable piece of racial slander. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Possibly the best of a bad group of terms. If somebody was going to insult me, I could sure do worse than being called a Celestial. Presumably, it's because China used to call itself by a name that was translated into English as the Heavenly Kingdom or the Celestial Empire. Celestials. Slurs are a really fascinating area of speech, but it's hard to explore that area for obvious reasons. When people don't trust each other, then slurs can be explosive, reminding everyone of the worst potential actions that could be taken in connection with the language of insult. Fighting words, I guess. In order to initiate a fight, you start saying really crude and awful and overgeneralized and incorrect things about a person and their presumed background. That's how you do it. It works best, of course, when people are on edge already. And one of the reasons people might already be on edge is that folks who share a lot of their particular background have, in fact, been attacked, abused, and suppressed with great frequency. That puts them naturally on edge, and so insults are more likely to be taken as fighting words. Although today, the problem is partly nested in our communication networks. We have access to so much decontextualized content from people and conversations that we're not really in that we just can't get a read on how dangerous a given slur might be. In person, having a good time with people you trust or with whom you are willing to engage in curiosity and open-ended inquiry that temporarily brackets stressful concerns, you may well accept all kinds of words that would seem explosively upsetting if you saw them used totally out of context in a tweet from someone you don't really know. It's one thing for Larry David and Leon to joke together about racial slurs on Curb Your Enthusiasm, but when you see the same word with no social or physical or emotional context sent to you at light speed from the other side of the world, you might err on the side of caution by assuming it's being used as fighting words.
Thank you.
That was the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme by Luciano Michelini. We were just talking about fighting words, and even though fighting words aren't necessarily about race, they do focus often on generalized caricature and potentially insulting material about groups and people's backgrounds. We all know this is really bad in some settings and not that bad in other settings. We're just not sure in any given case what kind of setting we're in or anyone else is in and who we're dealing with and how serious we should take the option of connecting that terminology to broader social danger patterns. However, there is this lingering sense that even when the words themselves are commonly ascribed to racial slurring effects, that those words are not necessarily the culprits. It's become cliche to say that, well, we can use that word, and that means, among other things, that when it's people we trust, people who we think get it, we're not as worried as we are among people we don't trust to deploy those same syllables. It means we sort of acknowledge that the problem is not exactly the racist terminology, which another group of people might use more innocently or ironically or evilly or productively. The problem is something that sometimes expresses itself as racially slurish terminology. And perhaps that same something, that same problem, expresses itself at other times in ways that don't immediately seem to be about race, and we might miss those if we're thinking too much about the most obvious ways to categorize people. And speaking of how our communication technology plays into this, let's bring up Canada's favorite late-life convert to Catholicism, Marshall McLuhan. Mr. Medium is the message, and for a brief time in 1964, contender for the Mr. Universe North bodybuilding title. Sadly, he lost to Jordan Peterson, who was 4 years old at the time. Never mind that nonsense. McLuhan predicted a massive resurgence of tribalism that would follow in the Finnegan's wake of electronic communication devices proliferating. As we get instant speed of light messages from everywhere in the world at once, we lose the sense that we are authentically anchored where we are and in who we are. Normal habits of group identification are challenged or dissolved, he said. You meet people from other groups that have more in common with you than people in your own town. You see news from distant parts of the world as readily as you learn the events in your own town. You are besieged by a billion distant perspectives. It's harder and harder to hold on to a sense of secure identity in the traditional sense. And what do people do traditionally when they feel their group identity slipping away? Well, McLuhan said they fight. That's the ancient method of establishing collective boundaries. Join a team and pick a fight. That's how the lines got drawn anciently that became the races and geographies and nations that we inherit today. By pushing against something, you get a more defined sense of yourself. And when a team pushes against another team, they get a collectively more defined feeling of self. The problem, of course, is that this engenders polarization, fragmentation, anti-individualism, and violence as people are herded by their anxiety and symbolism into feeling that they belong to this or that interest group and then serving that group by policing that group and entering into the fray as an intergroup warrior, verbally at first, but perhaps later even physically. The natural and predictable outcome of mobile phones and television.
Once upon a time there was a town where chaos reigned. Lawlessness was everywhere, and there was no cohesive theory existing which properly explained the mass media and their impact on society and man's thinking. And then one day a stranger came riding into town, and all the townsfolk gathered round and asked him his name. Well, he tipped his hat and he said, Marshall, Marshall McLuhan. Well, they gave him a star and put it on his chest and gave him his own office with his name on the door. Well, wouldn't you know, the very next day a fight broke out in the Last Chance Saloon. It was an argument concerning the externalization of the senses and its subsequent effect on man's psychological makeup. It was about to come to blows when Marshall stepped in and he said, boys,
a theory of cultural change is impossible without knowledge of the changing sense ratio affected by various externalizations of our senses.
Marshall McLuhan, you're such a groovy thinker.
say, 'cause you've got the best insights into mass media. This out of the Rio Grande.'
Well, then came the fateful day when a tall, dark man all dressed in black came riding into town. All the townsfolk ran inside and locked their doors and hid. And the bad man stood in the town square and he called out for Marshall McLuhan. He said, 'Marshall, I don't agree with your description of television as a tactile medium in the context of a visual notion of causality.' So Marshall shot him.
Marshall McLuhan, you're such a groovy thinker, and we really dig what you say, 'cause you've got the best insights into mass media. This side of the Rio Grande. Marshall McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan.'
Part of racism, of course, is the issue of racial stereotypes. And yes, I'm saying issue. Racial stereotypes are an interesting thing to examine when we're trying to figure out how much of racism is about race. Obviously, there's something that goes wrong in human communities that sometimes expresses itself through disrespectful and dehumanizing and incorrect caricatures of groups of people. On the other hand, it's very natural and normal historically for human beings to think in terms of cartoonish caricatures. Most people tend to think and talk, at least initially, in broad, generalized imagery. People who are immersed in cosmopolitan life, in the world of universities, mainstream media, and elite political and business cities, can tend to become chauvinistic about contemporary values, nuances, and speech trends. These people tend to generate new language fads and come to new agreements about what's okay to say to whom and about whom in order to sound up to date and to avoid giving offense. But casually offensive terminology is part of almost every natural community. And most people in the world are not university educated. Most people disagree with the ethos generated in capital cities and mainstream news agencies. Most people think in stereotypes about all kinds of areas of life. And that doesn't mean they're necessarily a problem or deplorable. If your grandpa refers to groups of people in ways that make you cringe because they sound like inaccurate and offensive generalizations, that doesn't automatically make him a racist. And if you keep talking with him, you might discover that he doesn't have the simplistic attitudes or dangerous prejudice that you might assume naturally go with that kind of speech. He isn't necessarily a problem, even though he's a racist. Or he isn't necessarily a racist, even though he uses stereotypes. I'm not sure which it is, but I do feel a bit suspicious that the racism of stereotypes is not the same kind of racism that we need to weed out of the culture completely. Consider The Simpsons. Some folks over the years have complained that the beloved character Apu is not a good representation of the East Indian people with his comical accent voiced by a non-Indian. Seems like it's about race. But Fat Homer Simpson is not a good representation of a white guy, and he's voiced by a non-fat guy. I think the boy on the show is voiced by a girl, etc. So two questions. These misrepresentational stereotypes, are they not directly about race, and are they not directly socially problematic? When there's a negative race-related social pattern that shows up in connection with misrepresentational stereotypes, do we know that those things are linked, or how linked are they? When are racist stereotypes part of a real and serious problem? And when aren't they? And is anyone asking these kinds of questions? I know it feels offensive to be caricatured. I cringe when I'm caricatured, but should I? Am I wrong to be bothered by cartoonish thinking if it's so normal among humans? Let's find out. Let's go to the phones. Caller 2, you're on the air.
Thank you. CILU is supported in part by the students of Lakehead University, our sponsors, and our listeners. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Rec and Culture Division of Thunder Bay, bringing free events to the waterfront and all of Thunder Bay. Check out thunderbay.ca/events for more info and follow them on Facebook. Joey's Restaurant, a tasty little place for seafood, located at 595 Arthur Street West. Visit them Tuesdays for all-you-can-eat fish and chips and Thursdays $5 fish tacos. Some conditions apply. The Thunder Bay Blues Fest. Log on to tbayblues.ca to keep up with all the news on Thunder Bay's largest annual music festival, entering its 19th year in 2020.
In the... I'm assuming 18th century, satirical novel Gulliver's Travels, Mr. John Swift sent his hapless protagonist to a kingdom of little people who famously tied him up. But what's not as well known is that they're engaged, those little people, those Lilliputians, in a ferocious civil war, rooted in their unmitigated hatred for the loathsome subhumans on the other side. They all have the same geography and skin color and speech patterns. They're not grouped by race or gender, but rather by a much more inane method. They disagree about how to eat boiled eggs. One group believes you should crack open a boiled egg from the narrow end first. The other group believes, rightly, in starting with the wide end. This ludicrous distinction into two groups leads to outright hostility, bias, and violence. Clearly, this is meant to mock human politics. But does it also tell us something? Is it an extreme fictional example of the premise that racism doesn't have to be about race? And I know that's a weird way of saying that, because what I mean is not that racism is unrelated to race, but that the underlying problem of how we identify and treat each other as groups in a toxic, inhuman, and even genocidal manner is something deeper and broader than our overt organization into racial categories. Genocide. That's an interesting word, isn't it? I don't mean to critique the word genocide the way my friend Doug does. Doug thinks it's a terrible word because most groups that get genocide aren't completely wiped out, whereas in a homicide, it's not really a homicide if the person is still alive, even if that person were brutally injured and lost most of their parts. That's Doug's take. He's a linguistic purist. I don't worry about that myself. My issue is that we still connect the problem of mass intergroup evil with the notion of easily recognized genetic subdivisions of our species. Genocide makes it sound like it's about the genes, doesn't it? And to be fair, it often is, if the neo-Darwinists are correct and our behavior frequently exhibits subhuman elements owing to the fact that we're controlled by ruthless integrated DNA viruses who want only to replicate themselves, who care nothing for people, and are actively hostile to groups with rival genes. What bugs me about that obviously true thing is that it overfocuses us sometimes. It leans into the easiest thing to think about on this topic. The easiest thing to get upset about on this topic. It tends to ignore both the fact that humans have an enormous, abstract, noospheric, cultural, mimetic dimension that is often as much or more responsible for our behavior than the genes, and it ignores how many rival gene packets that we feel no weird animosity towards. When was the last time you were racist against elm trees or tried to commit genocide against the genes of blue jays or parrots? Now, sure, there might be little nuances in neo-Darwinism that explain that, and maybe some people, I'm looking at you, Doug, are in fact racist against elm trees. But what I'm saying is that the thinking about genes, and more simplistically about simple, easy-to-see expressions of genes, like hair, skin color, height, jaw shape, etc., etc., are insufficient ways to organize our understanding of the stupid, awful, evil ways that human groups undermine and oppress each other. It's more complicated than those genes that are easy to see. And without taking anything away from anyone who suffers discrimination as part of an identified gene group, we should also be wondering whether or not we're missing part of the puzzle when we focus too narrowly on the interactions between obvious physiological visual categorizations of human beings.
Find a pine on it. Say I'm the only bee in your body.
I'm Layman Pascal, and you're listening to The Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM. I heard anecdotally that when the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek was in the army, the standard method of saying hello and getting to know people who were Bosnian, Serbian, Croat, or whatever in that region was offensive jokes. When you ran into people, you'd share with them all the preposterous slander you'd heard about them, and they'd share offensive material about you. But he said in the days and months leading up to the bloody war there in the 90s, people stopped sharing offensive things with each other. They lost the confidence to be casually racist with each other because something else was happening, something horrible. Now, we could easily say that the casual racism was bad and the bloody racism was worse. But we could also interpret that as a situation in which the racism by itself was not a social problem, was even a way of bringing people together, and then some other serious problem related to intergroup hostility broke out. Of course, the word racism is ambiguous. We all pretty much think we know what it means, but it's actually a melange of ideas. Is a racist merely someone who believes in race, believes that races exist? That doesn't seem quite right. Is it someone who believes the world ought to be divided into races? Is it someone who believes one particular race is better than one or several other particular races? And if you think one race is better, does it have to be your race? Are you racist if you think another race is better than yours? Is racism the same as racial superiority? Shouldn't that be called racial superiorism? And what about racial prejudice? Is it racist if you're fixated on race but not prejudiced toward any race? Some people say it's not enough to be non-racist, you have to be anti-racist. And by that definition, a non-racist is a racist. Other people have redefined racism as the intersection of power and privilege. So from that point of view, you could racially discriminate in a negative way, but if you lack power and privilege, your racism isn't racist. And for lots of people, racism has become a kind of casual epithet for any type of group discrimination, as if I was racist against postal workers or deep-sea divers. For some people, racism is synonymous with white supremacy, and they get confused if you point out negative things or discriminatory acts sourced in any other group. Clearly, lots of people who insist they aren't racist are racists, and that makes it different than most other ists and isms. You don't get to be an atheist if you always say you don't believe in atheism, but you might get to be a racist even if you always say you don't believe in racism. So it's a very odd word that has at least a superficial babble of meanings, even though most folks feel like they have a strong felt sense of what the word means. And strong felt senses are great, unless the thing you're feeling very strongly is not quite the same thing that you keep saying when you have that feeling. For example, I'm sure a lot of folks who say, border wall, actually don't think a wall is the solution, but they do feel strongly that something as definite as a wall, as basic as a wall, as resolute as a wall, is needed in our approach to securing our boundaries. The issue of comprehensible security is not quite the same issue as a wall, but those blur out for a lot of folks. Likewise, the problem indicated by racism is it's not quite the same as the relationship between groups that are identified as races, but that occurs often enough that the distinction blurs out for folks. Oxytocin. It used to be regarded as a love drug. It's a bonding hormone whose levels are elevated in the body when we're close to people we trust and when we get loving touches. For a while, and maybe still, corporations were trying to synthesize this and put it in body spray and cologne so men could purchase the ability to make women feel artificial trust and comfort around them. If you've got daughters, you should be preparing them to live in a world where certain types of men who might appear outwardly normal and conventional are watching YouTube videos about how to hack emotions, verbally reprogram women's brains, and buying products that hack their hormonal systems. Get ready for a world in which your feelings about people can be commercially manipulated. Get ready for a world where our pre-existing tendency to have dumb feelings and talk ourselves into stuff we don't really want to do is going to be amplified in the same sense that We used to read a book, and now we have 10,000 tweets, some of which are coming from robots, and most of which are trying to sell you on something, disguising that fact as though they were just coincidentally responding to your personal values. If you have daughters, try to figure out how to prep them for this. However, it turns out oxytocin is not a miracle love drug. It does increase your sense of trusting people who you already think are in your tribe, but it also makes you harsher toward people you believe are not in your tribe. It doesn't exactly create bonding, but rather it exaggerates your response to your ideas about who you are or are not bonded with. We have these chemicals whose job, it seems, is to jack up the degree to which we are irrationally supportive of people who feel like us, and irrationally inhibitory and antagonistic toward people who we don't feel look or sound like us. But we don't know the full scope of how flexible this process could be or has been. We know you can put people in psychological tests where they're just told they're in a group and they start to act that way, or they see their name on certain objects and they start to get protective of those objects and aggressive against other objects. We're kind of built psychologically and chemically to be programmable in terms of group identity. And if this leads to violence, oppression, inhumanism, destroyed lives, then that very serious problem and pattern may need to be addressed at a deeper level than the apparent group identities that people easily recognize and tend to associate themselves and others as being in. If I could create a group artificially that started to exhibit some of the same behavior, overtly or covertly, that makes racism such a problem in the world and throughout history, then the problem of racism isn't really about race. That race is just one easily recognized large-scale historical example of a much worse and much trickier problem. The great philosopher and leader of the Spanish Revolution, José Ortega y Gasset, was always at odds with his fellow members of the post-war Spanish Revolutionary Council because they wanted to get back to pure, authentic Spanishness. But he saw that Spanishness had been created, cultivated. He said the mountains and ocean that border Spain did not spring up around the Spanish people. Rather, non-Spanish people slowly became the Spanish by living between those mountains and oceans. Their environment and their practices created their ethnicity. Ethnicity is not primordial, it is produced. And over time, those people will start to sound alike, look alike, have common temperamental traits and a shared history and the whatnot. But this process could start anywhere, at any time. Some instances will be easier to see than others. The ones that are harder to see, though, still partake of this same process of shared identity building, and therefore they are also at risk of the same intergroup problems. Racism is probably a much bigger problem than is indicated by people's identification with races. I'm Layman Pascal, and you're listening to The Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM. Thank you. Let's talk about the Irish. Those fiendish Fenian fobs. It wasn't very long ago in North America when shops closed their doors to the Irish. People wouldn't hire them. Negative cartoonish stereotypes dominated discourse about them. They were slandered, attacked, considered to be a subhuman type, inherently less intelligent, less capable, and less trustworthy. The non-Irish majority not only oppressed Irish opportunities, but treated them generally with a kind of malevolent and sneering contempt. Racism. But was it? I mean, yes, it was, or it was certainly ethnocentric intergroup social hostility, but nowadays we don't often think of the Irish as being a separate race. They seem quite similar to the English, Scottish, French, Germans, and Russians, etc. At least when compared to the Japanese, Chinese, Africans, Australian Aborigines, the Irish seem to be whitish. Although white is sort of a made-up category that slowly absorbed a bunch of groups that used to treat each other as separate and mutually hostile races. So if that's the case, if that can happen in just a few hundred years, what does it mean in terms of how we think about these categories? Either the definition of race changes such that the problem of racism ultimately has to be different from our current definition of who the races are, or the problem of racism isn't quite related to races and shows up equally well in nationalistic and ethnocentric divisions that don't appear to be racial exactly. But then, what is the distinction between racism, nationalism, and ethnocentricity? Are those synonymous terms, or are they quite different phenomena that all get lumped together because of a few surface commonalities? Who's looking into this? Anyone? Is it a bad idea even to be talking about it? Is it a bad idea even to think that there's such a thing as a bad idea that shouldn't be talked about? How meta do we have to get here? Or are we just floating in the void now? Racism. Is it racist? Probably, but nevertheless and or nonetheless, we're poking around at that question today on The Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Layman Pascal, and you know, I recently watched Black Klansman, the Spike Lee and Jordan Peele film about the true story of a black cop who went undercover in the Ku Klux Klan back in the day. The arguable peak of the film, or what I call the unquilting point, the point after which in each film everything that has been held in suspense suddenly occurs rapidly, leading to the end of the film, there's the point where Spike Lee is cutting back and forth between a white supremacist meeting where people are shouting white power and a black student gathering where people are shouting black power. The director, presumably, is trying to make us confront both the similarities and the differences of these two phenomena. We could make the overly simplistic correlation between them and say that white power and black power, or any mobilized group of people who wish to empower their kind relative to everyone else, is socially problematic. But these two groups, they're not mirror images of each other. The black power group in the film contains a lot of young university women trying to learn about how people have been injured, treated as less than universal human beings. They want to expand the egalitarian space. Although the idiocy of group identification and even violence if necessary may be a part of that at times. The white power group, however, is notably characterized in the film by a few of its primary members being weird, perverted purists with low education and a wild chip on their shoulder. Yes, both groups are chanting and making threats and hating how the system is sabotaging their perceived quality of life, using their skin color as a rallying cry, but in the film, only the white power group is really beholden to these frothing, bitter people who mistake the national homeland for their own homes and who want to get the invaders out and protect the blood purity and the virginal motherland from desecration and filth and rapacious invasion. So what's interesting to me in all that is the problem here is, again, not exactly the racism. You could make a decent argument, and Spike Lee almost does this visually, that the black power movement is just as racist in the technical sense, just as focused on the empowerment of a race, even at the expense of existing cultural norms and situational decency. But if we call that racism, then that's not exactly the problem, is it? The problem with the white power group is not that white people are trying to affirm their whiteness, any more than it's a problem that the black people are trying to affirm their blackness. The problem is some kind of emotional plague, some kind of psychosexual or unconscious perversion that characterizes a lot of those particular white power folks. Something is wrong with them. A Chinese medicine doctor would pick out their symptoms immediately. Their obsessions, their seething, they're unnaturally worked up, they're substituting their own lives for an imaginary fantasy of the nation and race relations with bile dripping from their mouths and sneers on their faces, an almost desperate, perversely erotic desire to get into an ecstasy of desecration and expulsion. That's not really about how they see race. How they see race is just an area in which this toxicity is coming forward. So is there an emotional disease that lurks in some racists and some non-racists, but not all racists and definitely not all non-racists, a dangerous disease bad for society that we might not be able to reckon with effectively if we always only focus on the times that it shows up in its racialist disguise? Is this even a sensible question to ask? I just hope there isn't something really dangerous about racism that isn't exactly the racism that we might miss if we always focus on the race, even though we've obviously got to focus on the racism. We were just talking about fighting words, and even though fighting words aren't necessarily about race, they do focus often on generalized caricature and potentially insulting material about groups and people's backgrounds. We were just talking about fighting.
We all know this.
And even though
really
fighting words aren't necessarily about race, they do focus often on generalized caricature
in given case,
and potentially insulting material
or anyone else's
and
who
people
we're dealing
with, and how serious we should take the option.
We all know this is really
that
bad in some settings and not that bad in other settings. However, sure it is given case.
Necessarily are among people we don't trust to deploy those same syllables. It means we sort of acknowledge that the problem is not exactly the racist terminology, which another group of people might use more innocently or ironically or evilly or productively. The problem is something that sometimes expresses itself as racially slurred terminology, and perhaps that same something, that same problem, expresses itself at other times in ways that don't immediately seem to be about race, and we might miss those if we're thinking too much about the most obvious ways to categorize it. And speaking of how our communication technology plays into this, let's bring up Canada's favorite late-life convert to Catholicism, Marshall McLuhan. Mr. Medium is the message, and for a brief time in 1964, contender for the Mr. Universe North bodybuilding title. Sadly, he lost to Jordan Peterson, who was 4 years old at the time. Never mind that nonsense, McLuhan predicted a massive resurgence of tribalism that would follow in the Finnegan's wake of electronic communication devices proliferating. As we get instant speed of light messages from everywhere in the world at once, we lose the sense that we are authentically anchored where we are and in who we are. Normal habits of group identification are challenged or dissolved, he said. You meet people from other groups that have more in common with you than people in your own town. You see news from distant parts of the world as readily as you learn the events in your own. You are besieged by a billion distant perspectives. It's harder and harder to hold on to a sense of secure identity in the traditional sense. What do people do traditionally?